Hey, Properly Howard fans, just a note before we get going. Steve and I are helping David from the Lorehounds cover Alien Earth for episodes 5 and 6. Episode 5 is out right now. You could go listen to that by searching Alien Earth Lorehounds. Because Steve and I are both really interested in this show, we're going to be fielding questions about it next week. So if you have any questions about Alien Earth on FX/Hulu, or the Alien franchise as a whole, send those to cocoonsofhorror@gmail.com. Okay, let's hear Mickey yell at Rocky.
Well, now you'll try.
What about my brand, Nick? At least you have.
Welcome to Properly Howard, a podcast that reviews classic films and other pulp fiction. Today we take a look at John Hughes' Planes, Trains, and Automobiles. Starring Steve Martin and John Candy as odd couple travelers, Planes, Trains, and Automobiles explores holidays and adult relationships and the evil nature of car rental agencies. With me to discuss this, as always, is Dr. Yeah. Anthony LaDon.
So Trains, Planes, and Automobiles. Early 90s, if you wanted a comedy that was going to make everyone in your family laugh. And I'm not saying that this was a PG movie. I mean, you do have the F word several times in the movie, but I think that this always had the reputation for, this is just a movie that is always going to deliver.
Yeah.
Do you feel like that's held up? I feel like this movie has kind of been relegated.
Well, I think part of this movie's issue with maybe staying power for us is because we've watched it so many times. It's almost like, do you enjoy watching The Christmas Story?
I do, but
do you enjoy, is it feel more tradition than it does a treat?
I like it. I just think it's good. I think it's funny. I think it's gonna be funny when I'm 70 years old. It'll still be funny, but I consciously choose not to watch it at Christmas time because it's like, if I watch it every Christmas, it'll lose its luster.
I think that's kind of where I'm at with Planes, Trains, and Automobiles. I mean, okay. To me, when this first came out, I thought this was like the height of comedy.
Okay. Yeah. The great example, right?
Yeah.
Great example that it had that reputation as maybe being one of the top five comedies ever when it came out.
Right. It was, it was. I mean, because I think we look at everything maybe a little more critically than we did when we were like 11 or 12.
But I remember adults. I mean, I remember adults quoting this movie to me. Just lines and just the. I think this was the first movie that I ever saw that made fun of homophobia.
Right.
You know, it wasn't the joke wasn't like, isn't fair, yeah. You know. Isn't that gay guy funny, or wouldn't it be funny if, you know, there was a gay guy around that we could make fun of? Feels like there was a lot of that. This is the first movie that was like, here are two heteronormative guys who are pretty homophobic and they're putting themselves in an awkward situation. This is kind of hilarious that these guys are so homophobic.
Right.
And sort of making up for it. So, I mean, I remember adults quoting bits and pieces of this movie to me. There's a lot of adult humor in this movie. I mean, what kids are doing business travel? So I don't think this was a movie that we as kids just thought was funny.
You know, I think it's kind of appropriate that this movie follows our review of Friendship.
Yeah.
And Friendship is a much more cynical view on male friendship, right? And especially like kind of two guys thrust together and trying to make it work. Whereas this is, you know, starts off cynical and then turns more sweet, right? Like, I mean, this, I think it's an interesting juxtaposition of where we are today and maybe where our sensibilities are and humor. Because
this movie ends is like,
it's hopeful.
It's like Thanksgiving as a family, and it also includes the family we found along the way. Friendship right. ends with a guy getting in a cop car.
Because he was threatening to shoot all of the guys that didn't like him enough.
So, yeah, you're right.
Which this, is more realistic. It's always... funny because we watched this movie last night with Heather and I watching it. And at the end, like, you know, it's got this little sweet little moment of John Candy. And I'm like, and as soon as it fades out, I go, and then he shoots everybody in the house.
I was going to ask that. I was like, John Candy totally kills his wife, right?
And that's exactly what I said afterwards. I'm like, he kills them all the same way he killed his wife.
He's a serial killer, this guy.
Right. You let him in. They invited him in. This is the killer on the road that Jim Morrison was trying to warn us about.
but I think you're right. That's a cynical approach, right? It does feel like this is friendship in reverse. Like if you play Transplants and Automobiles backwards, you get the movie Friendship.
Yeah, so I think that's an interesting way to look at it, right? Because I think when you're younger, you kind of just see, and when I mean younger, I mean maybe, like you said, adults like this movie and still do. And there's nothing wrong with that. I think it's a good movie. I think it's funny. I think there are elements of complexity about the characters that would have been more fleshed out in today's filmmaking style, right? Like, it's hard to know who the bad guy is, which means it's hard to know who the good guy is.
You know, I was going to ask you that. I was going to say, this movie almost does a little flipperoo on you. Like, immediately you identify with Steve Martin because you have Steve Martin who's put forth as every man, and he's in New York City, and New York City is populated by heartless morons or people who just don't care about you. And so you identify.
And we know he has a family, and knows family.
You got it. You want to get this guy out of New York City back to his family for Thanksgiving. Like, what's not relatable about that? But then along the way, it's like, oh, this poor guy has to put up with this boorish, chatty Cathy of a human. And then something flips along the way where you're like, wait a second, is Steve Martin the asshole? Because I'm starting to like John Candy. It's kind of a magic trick what this movie does.
And then as it goes on, you're like, no, John Candy's a prop.
And then at the end, you're like, John Candy's a serial killer.
Well, because, I mean, you've got the whole issue with the, you find out, like, I mean, he does use his card. And, like, everything is, I intended on doing this thing, but we don't know that he intended on doing it. He intends to now because they're back together again.
Okay, I'm going to ask you a question. I'm going to play you something.
I know you, don't I? I'm usually very good with names, but I'll be damned if I haven't forgotten yours.
You stole my cab.
I've never stole anything in my life.
I hailed a cab on Park Avenue this afternoon, and before I could get in it, you stole it.
You're the guy who tried to get my cab. I knew I knew you. Yeah. You scared the bejesus out of me. Come to think of it, it was awful easy to get a cab during rush hour.
Forget it.
Well, I can't forget it. I am sorry. I had no idea that was your cab. Let me make it up to you somehow, huh, please? How about a nice hot dog and a beer?
No, thanks.
Just a hot dog, then.
I'm kind of picky about what I eat.
Some coffee?
No.
Milk?
No.
Soda?
No.
Some tea?
No.
Lifesavers?
No.
Slurpee?
Sir.
Lifesavers is funny.
Lifesavers is funny.
I think my reading of this is that, of course he knew he stole his cab. And he's feigning... I thought it was my cab, but now in retrospect, I can see that I got it too easy. It must have been your cab. Let me make it up to you. I think that's all put on. I mean, that's my reading of that scene. In other words, he has stole things in his life. This is not someone that you want to trust. I don't know if you know that at this point in the movie, but I think that in retrospect, I'm supposed to think that he is not someone you can trust, really.
Yeah, I think that's sort of my criticism of this film, is that I can read it, but I don't know if that's what it's telling me, and I'm not sure what they're telling me about the John Candy character, for sure. Because they do a lot to try to make him seem very wholesome and kind of naive, and as, like you said, at the beginning of the movie, you know, Steve Martin is, for this environment in New York, and he wants to get home to his family. His family is his top priority. So you kind of appreciate that he's working this job and dealing with the stress of New York and all this because he wants to provide for his family, as opposed to like he just wants to make it big, right? So they do a pretty good job of I think putting those things together really early. So we want Steve Martin to get home. You know, he's out in the city doing all this stuff so he can go home and blah, blah, blah. But then you juxtapose him with John Candy's character, and suddenly he becomes all of the people that we were sort of rooting against in the New York world, right? He's a reflection of that now. So I don't know if that's the movie being very clever, because it is kind of an interesting move, if that's the case, or if it loses sight of what it's trying to do. So that's where I get, like, I'm not sure if the movie's, like, really adept or kind of accidentally.
Does John Hughes know whether John Candy is nefarious or not?
And that's my question when I watch this movie. And I wonder if I think that might shape some of my disconnect with it in a later watch. I mean, and it could just very well be that at the end of the day, like, look, they both have issues and they're thrust together and they're forced to now view their issues together, right? Like, they, you know, it's, you go through life, you go through everything. Maybe you don't have any kind of challenges that make you look at some of the things that, like, maybe Steve Martin's character blows up like this with his wife and kids all the time. And so his reaction to John Candy in that hotel room, maybe that's who he is, or is that a breaking point for him? Like, there's a lot of questions that come out of that you look at that and go, it's an amazing monologue, by the way, but at the same time you're like, well, that's pretty rough. But at this, that, like, as an adult, like as a kid, you're like, oh man, he's really giving him the what for. And as soon as it switches over to John Candy's, you know, I like me, my wife likes me, all that, like, oh, that's super sweet, Steve Martin's a jerk. But then now I'm looking at it the whole time, but I'm like, yeah, then, dude, let him. I'm like, watch it now, and I'm like, yeah, dude, let him have it, dude.
Even then, it reads as sincere. It's like, you've hurt me, and now you've got me vulnerable, and I'm going to tell you what's in my deepest, darkest self. I like me. My wife likes me. That's a lie, too.
Yeah. Yeah.
I mean, he's still
gaslighting him.
He's still and here's my view on this. My view on this is, he's conning him into being his friend. Like, this whole thing is a long con, but he doesn't want to empty Steve Martin's wallet. Even though he does, you know, get him to pay for the cab ride and the hotel, and he ends up using his credit card to get the rental car,
which is going to absolutely come back to bite Steve Martin now.
But I think what he really wants is, he wants a family for Thanksgiving. And the idea is, if I can get this guy to pay for a bunch of things and then get him to give me his phone number and address, then I can go and pay him back and I'll be a hero because I'm a stranger who was good on my word. Oh, and by the way, I happen to be in town. Why don't you stay with us for Thanksgiving? I think that that's the con. In this movie, I don't think it's the money is the end game. I think he does think, I will pay this guy back. But what he really wants is, he wants a family for Thanksgiving. Which kind of makes you feel a little bit like, oh, you know, help a guy out. He just wants a connection in the world. In another way, you're thinking, that's actually even
yeah, more sinister.
That's psycho. That's a little bit psycho.
Yeah, and so that's where I'm wondering, like, because I mean, maybe this is the cynical view, right? Maybe this is the reason why we think friendship is wonderful, and then we go, well, let's the problem is us.
You know, because like, I guess, is it really bad? Is it really bad to want someone else to like you? You know, how often do we trick people into liking us by just smiling at them when, you know, it's like that's what they want. You know, you exchange pleasantries with people, not because this is how you really feel. It's just this is how you act in the world, and it'll make people feel better. And then people will think you're a nicer person. You know, isn't that all a deception?
So I think a lot of John Hughes' movies are suggesting that you don't really need therapy. Just push it all down and get along. Because if you look there's a problem with Del Griffith, right? I mean, he says he has no home. Where's he going? What was his plan at all? You know, what was he doing, and how was he going to do any of it? And this is where I think the issue that I have too, in terms of like, where I wonder, well, what are you trying to tell us, John Hughes, about these characters? Because Steve Martin comes all the way back, and it's like he's just sitting there, and so we're building up to this moment where you know, John Candy's just sitting there, and he's sad, and his story was sad. Turns to find out that his wife's dead, and they're like, and that is supposed to almost be enough, right? There's a sad story that gives some sort of a justification maybe for some of his behavior, but certainly not all of it. I mean, it helps me understand, you know, why I should be sympathetic for him for some of it, but
it does not justify someone taking off their shoes and socks.
Just because his wife died 8 years ago doesn't mean that he can, you know, drive like a maniac, use your credit card, and you know, all of that stuff. You know what I mean? It's like that's a problem. That's not an excuse. It's part of the story. It's part of his narrative, but it's not like a justification for everything else that's come up to that moment. But sometimes movies, and maybe it's a holiday movie thing, right? I mean, this is for sure a holiday movie, but like where there's, you can go through a lot. Like, I think we've talked about this before in movies like Avatar, where like, we're not going to develop the main character. We're not going to give you really any reason to root for him, but we're going to put him in a wheelchair, and that should be enough. You know what I mean? Like, just give one reason to suggest why you should feel sorry for. And if you can feel sorry, it's interesting to make, if you can feel sorry for a character, they become a protagonist by default,
right?
So that's why I wonder like, but the way that wraps up and the way that all is sort of forgiven because we find out that his wife had died, you're like, well, that's why I don't know that I can give the Hughes writing enough credit to say that this is what they're trying to do with John Candy's character, because I don't think you can do all those other things and then tidy up a little bow at the end to go, oh yeah, but his wife died a long time ago. So, you know.
Okay. Have you seen the Steve Martin documentary?
I have not.
Okay. I'm going to play you a clip from the Steve Martin documentary.
John Candy was very sensitive and very complex, and we really loved each other.
I had a beautiful scene. Look, I'm not going to read this speech, but it's that long. We're at a train station, and he gives the entire explanation of his life. And I was opposite him. I was, like, weeping as he was performing it. And it was all cut. So I don't know why it was cut, except for tempo, and maybe you're at the end, and you don't want to hear a long speech. It was cut down to a line or two.
I don't have a home. Marie's been dead for 8 years.
There was a line I loved. It says, I sort of attach myself to people from time to time, like with you, especially around the holidays. I can take it in March, July, October, but it gets hard. And then he said, this time I couldn't let go.
So this is...
So there it is. that there's the thing.
So this is him saying, I'm looking for family around the holidays. And it's an entire speech that gets cut. So would, if that speech had been included in full, would that have helped the movie?
I think 100%. Because what are we talking about right now? We're talking about like, is who's, what's the motivation? Is this, you know, does the director even know what he's writing, or is he, you know, and like, it's, so this shows that like, yeah, they did flesh this out. They did have a, you know, to kind of quote the other monologue, hey, when you're telling a story, have a point. It makes it so much more enjoyable for the listener.
You know, everything is not an anecdote. You have to discriminate. You choose things that are funny or mildly amusing or interesting. You're a miracle. Your stories have none of that. They're not even amusing accidentally.
So this is interesting to me because here we have an example of a movie that had kind of a bow tied at the end that would have, you think would have improved it. But in many of our other conversations, you have said, I kind of like the ambiguity because it allows me to figure it out. And if you've done your job as a storyteller, I'll have enough to work with. But it could be that this is an exception, or maybe John Hughes just didn't do enough of the storytelling in the middle to do without the ending.
Right, because it doesn't... The way that my preference would work, you don't go back to the train station at all. You don't bring him home. If you do those things, now you have to have some sort of a reveal, and this movie does not have the it thinks the reveal is enough. So the speech where that would reveal all that, to me, that would make the ending a twist. And
interesting,
I'd be more compelled to go, well, now I want to watch the movie through that lens. Wow, that's, now I'm watching a different movie on rewatch. Because it actually is a twist, right? Because instead of it just being like, they take this, in my opinion, kind of a lazy way out. Because like I said, they don't put you in a situation where you're like, is he good? Is he bad? It's like, no, because at the end they're telling you, no, it's good. See, look at, you can tell by the music. You can tell by the framing. You can tell by everybody that's in the scene that this is a happy ending. So, yeah. So if you go through the effort to tell me that, you have to tell me why. Because that's not just ambiguity for ambiguity's sake, like leaving out like an important thing is not the same as like having an ambiguous ending, especially in a holiday movie that is going to have a happy ending. You've created a complex world that doesn't feel nearly as complex because of the ending. So if there's a complexity, don't shortchange us from that. Because I mean, think about that. Just what you played there, the idea that he's just, you know, that he kind of has been pulling the strings on this.
Yeah.
That's crazy to me. That is crazy. And here's the thing is, I maybe this is to their credit to some degree. If you do that monologue and you have him explain that, does that make it easier for you to accept him going to the house or harder? I think it's harder.
Because then it's like, man.
Because it's, I think, tough. A Steve Martin character would be like, what have I got? Like, that's a better ending.
You know, if you're going to fast forward a month later and he's still going to be living in your house.
Mm-hmm.
And he's going to be like getting pretty chummy with your uncle. And he's going to be at your poker game. And all of a sudden it's like, now my life includes this guy.
Right? Now you have friendship. Now you've got the movie Friendship.
Sure. Yeah. 15 minutes into this movie, I wrote down, Steve is totally blank and I am totally blank. In other words, I associate me with one of these characters and you with one of these characters. What do you think I wrote down?
I think you wrote down that you're Steve Martin and I'm John Candy.
That I'm Steve Martin and you're John Candy.
Yeah.
And then I revised it. I was like, that's not quite right. I think that I am Steve Martin.
You're Edie McClurg.
Yeah, I'm no kidding. I do feel like Edie McClurg. I think that this has to do with our relationship to strangers and conversations with strangers. I think in private, I'm John Candy with you. and you're Steve Martin. But in public, you're John Candy. You are the kind of guy who will strike up a conversation with a stranger and be pretty friendly and, you know, get to know him a little bit. Like, you know, we have 10 minutes at the bar together. Why don't we get to know each other just a little bit? I kind of see you in the John Candy part, but only in public.
Interesting.
What do you think about that?
I think that might check out. It might be fine.
All right, listen to this.
Del Griffith, American Light and Fixture, Director of Sales, Shower Curtain Ring Division. I sell shower curtain rings. Best in the world. And you are?
Neil Page.
Neil Page. Pleased to meet you, Neil Page. So what do you do for a living, Neil Page?
So I'm curious, have you ever had a conversation with a stranger on an airplane before? Are you the kind of guy who's like, this is what I do for a living. This is what you do for a living. Like, have you had those conversations in the world? Or is this something that you just do with strangers when you got a couple drinks and you at the bar?
I think it kind of depends on the environment. Like if something's not going well, like let's say it is an airport thing and it is like a delay of some sort, if there's an opportunity maybe for have to some sort of commiseration, I might be a little more inclined to maybe look for an ally.
All right, okay. You would do much better on Survivor than I would, I think.
Probably.
So, okay, so that was my impression.
I can go.
And it sounds like that there was a little bit of warrant. There's a little bit of warrant in my perception. What's your perception? Did you associate these guys with us?
A little bit, but I was like, I think sometimes we're both Steve Martin.
I think that that's the idea, like, because he is the hero of the story, right?
And well, like I look at it more of we're not afraid to tell somebody that they're boring.
I was thinking about the I don't know what the guy was singing. We were like crossing the street in New York, and there was a guy next to us that was being serenaded.
Oh, that's right.
By some random dude. And then he was Irish.
That's right.
He was Irish and he was serenading the guy next to us. And then he was like kind of sarcastically asking him, like, do you think I'm a great singer? Do you think I'm a great singer? And I just laid into him because I just thought it was completely rude.
Yeah, yeah.
And I just thought in that moment, I was absolutely Steve Martin.
Yeah, for sure. So that's right.
I forget what he was singing.
Yeah, I mean, I think part of the issue too is, and this is because I don't think that these characters are fully, like we said, as fleshed out as maybe they could be. I don't know that a lot of my social interactions with people are meant for good.
Oh, interesting. Like, I was gonna.
There might be a little bit of mining for maybe a bit, or there might be a little, you know, watch the world burn, go along with it. You know, my penchant for Schadenfreude is kind of like rules everything.
Well, and I was going to ask you, how many of these conversations do you think might eventually turn into a bit?
Yeah, I mean, that's quite possible. So there might be a selfish quality to that type of interaction.
All right, interesting. So you used the phrase for the good. How big of an overlap is there in the Venn diagram of good and likable? Because I think a lot of people would think, well, you're just a good person. It'll sort of be evident in the world. Like, people will just think that you're likable. But I think that that's almost a deception. I don't think that there's zero overlap, but I feel like goodness is not about trying to make people like you.
Yeah, I agree. In fact, I think the more good a person is, it's quite possible that their unlikability is relatively high. That's what eulogies are for.
I mean, I have a colleague who just took a job at a different institution. Like, he left, he was at my school for a long time, and I think he was genuinely a good person, but he was kind of a curmudgeon. And I kind of respected it. It's like, sometimes we'd butt heads, but I think, you know, there was a little bit like, I don't think you're very likable, but I feel like you're kind of a good person.
But I respect you.
Yeah, I respect you, but not just respect. Respect, like, I feel like if there was a choice between right and wrong, you would choose the right choice most of the time. But it doesn't necessarily mean that we're going to be best friends, right?
Sure.
So I do think that there's something about being a good person. I mean, an extreme example of this is that, like, people that knew Mother Teresa kind of felt like she was a bit of a tyrant. Like, she had an idea, she had a vision for what the world should be like, and she would steamroll people to get to that end.
Finally, someone bringing her down a peg.
I mean, that was sort of the what people said about her later in life, is that she was just kind of hard to be around. But there's no doubt in my mind that she was doing something good in the world. So I think that there's something interesting here about the idea that I think someone like John Candy can fool a lot of people just because he's pretty affable, and it makes him a good salesman. I think really good salesmen, I don't know if they know the line between I'm selling you and I'm making a new friend.
Right.
And I think that that's kind of, it's a special skill that salesmen have. And for me, I'm suspicious of it.
Sure.
Now, of course, I like to think of myself as a good person, but you give me like literally 5 minutes at a fantasy football draft. And
you are neither good nor likable.
I become a depraved lunatic. At the end of our fantasy football draft, I hated everyone in that room. I hated you. I hated your phone, your stupid technology. It was just like, what is it about football? What is it about football that just brings out the absolute worst in people? Or me, maybe just me.
Yeah, I mean, maybe it's a thing.
I don't know. I don't know if I need a universal.
In the world of root cause analysis, we like to do these five whys, and so like we just sort of work back from the problem statement, and then we try to find out what we're at from. So I think that's good. You just sort of went from, you narrowed the scope. Football might not be the worst thing for people, but it for sure is for you.
I don't know what it is, but. Like, I convinced myself I was a pretty good person for a while, and then give me 5 minutes in a fantasy football draft. I'm like, no, I'm going to hell. I'm absolutely going to hell for sure.
Oh, man. That's interesting too about this character, and that's why I think that the left out monologue is so key, because if you look at this film as somebody who is kind of grifting for a friendship, already suggests a deficiency in understanding what a friendship even is, right? So there's a certain detachment that this person has with reality and with people that I think is really it's fascinating, and it becomes much more of a wildly intriguing character study as opposed to he's likable and misunderstood, because that's easy, right? I mean,
whereas
to a certain
Steve
degree,
Steve Martin, you would think he's kind of not likable. Like he might have good reason, but he's not a golden retriever in this movie. He's a cat right. in this movie, but you kind of forgive him because it's like everything bad that could happen to someone has happened to this guy in this trip.
And it's a lot of it is by the hands of this likable fellow.
And like on top of that,
how likable can anyone be to justify certain things, right?
He's motivated to get back to his wife and kids at Thanksgiving. Like, what's not likable about that?
Mm-hmm.
Does it justify the way he speaks to Edie McClung? Probably not, but you can kind of imagine yourself in that situation.
Yeah, I find him actually, interestingly, in that situation, at his most relatable in the movie. Because like where you just get pushed over the edge. It's one thing to lash out to Del Griffith after all that they've been through together. That's fine. And you kind of feel bad for maybe the Del's reaction and everything. But Edie McClurg is she's working the desk at a car rental agency. And we all have been in a situation similar to that where something has just pushed us over the edge. And we're going to be our worst version of ourselves mm-hmm. in that moment. And I never read that even as a kid as like, oh man, he's really a bad guy. That to me was like the sort of a nice encapsulation of we all have boiling points.
Well, and if she's not having that long conversation about Thanksgiving with her relative while the right. line is just piling up, that it's really important to have that little bit. Because...
Yeah, if he just comes in guns blazing for no real good reason,
right.
then
that's right.
And I do think I do think it's interesting too, because if you look, especially if you add that monologue, Steve Martin's character becomes way more likable.
Yeah,
he brings the fan. He brings him in. I mean, he already is likable at the end because he decides to bring him into the house. But if he did that after this explanation and this kind of this heartfelt confession, I think that would kind of elevate the Steve Martin character in a very unique way, more so than just, oh, I feel sorry for him, his wife died. Like, that's kind of how it plays out. And I'm like, that's just not enough for me. And so, it might actually, complicate things, because I think it'd be way harder to bring that guy over after finding out that like this whole thing was kind of just a ruse, and because he's got a lot of issues, and it's like, is that really what you want to bring your family to? Like, that would be a really weird move on Steve Martin's part, or a very benevolent move on his part.
What's the best Steve Martin movie?
Parenthood?
Parenthood would be in the running for sure. I think depending on your tastes, it might be this movie.
Sure. I mean, I think this probably feels like...
Or Three Amigos?
Yeah, Three Amigos is... So the thing about Parenthood is he's so much more central, whereas like Planes, Trains, and Automobiles is a buddy movie. It's a Laurel and Hardy, right? Like, it's kind of impossible to have one versus the other, you know. Three Amigos, also very ensemble-ish. I would say that he might be the least funny of the three in the movie, but that's by design.
The movie doesn't work without him, I don't think.
Oh, I agree, but he plays the kind of heroic straight man to some degree, even though he's still out there. I love The Jerk. Absolutely.
Oh, The Jerk. Yeah, The Jerk.
Absolutely love The Jerk. There's movies of his that I enjoy. for sure. Like, I mean, I really like My Blue Heaven, Man with Two Brains.
There's a few movies that I used to really love. I used to love Roxanne. I tried to watch it recently.
It's a hard watch now.
What's the best John Candy movie?
It's probably not Hot to Trot.
No. I think we need to just check in with Hot to Trot just to make sure.
Good old Bobcat Goldthwait, Dabney Coleman, and John Candy is the voice of a horse. That's great.
I think it's this. I mean, Uncle Buck.
I don't love Uncle Buck on a rewatch.
But he's, you know, he's sort of like the titular Uncle Buck, right?
Right.
So I think it's sort of like maybe because he's second fiddle in this movie, that one gets elevated. I don't know if you're familiar with this scene in JFK.
Why are you dancing on my head for, my man? We've been thick as molasses pie since law school.
Keep conning me, Dean. I read your testimony to the Warren Commission.
There you go again, grain of salt.
You tell them the day after the assassination, you're called on the phone by this Clay Bertrand and asked to fly to Dallas and be Lee Oswald's lawyer.
Right. If I answer that question you keep asking, if I give you the name of the big enchilada, you know. Then it's Bon Voyage Dino. I mean like permanent. I mean like a bullet in my head, you dig? You're a mouse fighting a gorilla. Kennedy's as dead as that crab meat. The government's still breathing. You want to line up with a dead man?
My lips, Dino. Either you dance into the grand jury with the real identity of Claire Bertrand, or your fat behind's going to the slammer. Now you dig me?
You're as crazy as your mama. Goes to show it's in the genes.
I want you to know that entire scene, he's wearing a three-piece suit and dark Ray-Bans while they're in the restaurant. to me that scene is very funny, and half of it has to do with Kevin Costner's accent.
Yeah Is that his only dramatic role?
It might be, and it's quite a choice.
Yeah.
He's kind of like trying to be Scatman Crothers a little bit.
Aren't we all?
So I think that this might be the best John Candy. I think Trains, Planes, and Automobiles might be the best John Candy.
We put on Great Outdoors right afterwards.
Uh-huh. Did Tubi feed that to you?
No, it was on Netflix.
Okay.
So I always had an interesting relationship with Great Outdoors. Like, I always wanted to like it more than I did. And I think I like it more now than I used to.
I don't think I've ever seen it.
Written by John Hughes.
Interesting. Okay.
So there's definitely some similar type of, like, you know, he's the likable, ambitious dad. Dan Aykroyd is the opportunistic, wealthy brother-in-law who's coming in, horning in on their vacation, and, you know, making things hard for him. But then there's like this sort of reveal that makes, you know, a little more likable. So I'll have a look.
Last question before we get to our regular question.
Bet365 is paying out before the final whistle.
Check out Bet365's unrivaled early payout offer. When you bet on a team to win and they take a 17-point lead, you get paid no matter the final score. Forget the final whistle and start counting that cash. Hold up. You get early payout on parlays, too.
Download the app and see why it's never ordinary at Bet365. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. 21 plus only. Must be physically located in Ohio. T&Cs apply.
Wondering if dangerous contaminants are in your home's water? Get Leaf Home Water Solutions today. We can't live without water, but we can take actions today to make it safer and healthier. Leaf Home Water Solutions is offering a free in-home water test. Just visit leafhome.com/water to schedule yours. With results from their advanced digital testing, Leaf Home Water Solutions can design a whole home system and expertly install it in as little as one day. With Leaf Home Water Solutions, you can feel confident that each drop of water from every tap and appliance is cleaner and safer for you and your family. We can't live without water, but we can take actions today to make our family's water safer with Leaf Home Water Solutions. Schedule your free home water test today at leafhome.com/water and save 15% on all home water treatment systems. That's leafhome.com/water for your free home water test and 15% off. leafhome.com/water.
This is 1987. Steve Martin begins this movie wearing a fedora.
Mm-hmm.
And it doesn't like stand out like, oh, that's a choice. It just kind of fits with his costume. Is 1987 the last time you could wear a fedora and just be a regular guy?
Without it being like, hey, that guy's wearing a fedora.
Exactly.
Yeah, I think you're right. Anytime somebody has a fedora now, I assume that they are, this is their personality now.
That was a choice someone made. That was sort of like, I'm bringing it back, or I can pull this off.
Right.
At one point, you could wear a fedora with a suit, and that would be as common as someone wearing a baseball cap with a t-shirt. And at some point, that went away. And I think it's probably already going away at in 87. But I kind of feel like this is sort of the dying gasp of the fedora as common headwear.
I'm wondering, there's a part of me that wonders if the fedora shape has changed subtly enough over the course of the decades that it stands out more. Because like, if you put on a fedora, I put on a fedora. We never look like these guys that wear fedoras.
No, even if I wear a suit, I've had a suit on before, you know. Usually it's like in some kind of suit shop that happens to have a few hats as well. And you put it on and you're like, all of a sudden I'm in the 1940s and I'm like battling Indiana Jones for a
I'm in my
relic
noir
or something.
Phase.
Yeah, all of a sudden it's like, what is happening here? It would almost feel like it'd be better to wear a baseball cap with this suit. That would stand out less than
but let's look in 87 and in the 80s, I don't think we saw fedoras in the wild.
We wouldn't have seen them in the wild for sure, but of course, this is a John Hughes movie. And then the question is, did it strike us as odd that Steve Martin was wearing a fedora in New York City in 1987? I'm going to say no.
Right. No, I would say. Now, for us specifically, we, you know, having not been to New York at that age, having only, like, fedoras are cinematic.
They're very cinematic, yes.
And it
kind of does come into this movie when he, sort of at his lowest moment, a truck drives by and just destroys his hat.
Right.
That's the last straw. He's going to go lay into Edie McClurg at that point. So, yeah, I think that this is it. You're not going to get a fedora that doesn't stand out after this movie.
Yeah, and try as we might. It's just not, I mean, we've tried to resurrect that, but I just don't think we can do it.
Is there a trope, a cliche, or device that you liked in this movie?
I think I'm still a sucker for the, if something happens to your testicles, your voice goes higher.
Okay. This is a very John Hughes thing, but when Dylan Baker's introduced as Owen, who's just some guy's son, and he pulls up in his pickup truck. He steps out of the truck, and there's a slow pan up from his feet with very dramatic music until you get to his face. And I feel like that's in a lot of John Hughes movies.
Yeah.
So it's something like, oh, this is very John Hughes-y.
It's very clear that this next character is going to be a problem of some sort.
You were not expecting this on your journey.
Right.
Is there a tweak you'd make to the movie to improve it?
Well, there's two. One is the new one is leave that monologue in because it I no longer am asking the question of like, does this movie even know who these people are? Because I'm actually like, oh, you did. And you kind of held that back, which is a bummer. The other thing is there are some soundtrack choices that Hughes makes that's specifically Hughes that would work in, like, say, Ferris Bueller, but not in this film. There's some synth choices that kind of undercut the tone they're trying to set just because they're synth, which is a shame because the music, especially all of the music in the rental car scene, is really good and really captures the tone. It captures their age. And it reflects the sort of the chaos, but like whenever it would get a little dramatic, it would choose like just odd synth stuff that that's all you could think about. It's like when the saxophone won't shut up in Lethal Weapon to the point where you're like,
right.
Is this a character?
right, yeah. I'm gonna say more bacon. I mean, just seeing him at the beginning of this movie made me think, like, that's just underused bacon. That's undercooked bacon right there.
Yes. Yeah, I think Heather's take was like, don't have bacon, because then I'm like, I'm expecting there to be a reason.
Yeah, yeah. I want him to
become back. And then if there's not, you're like, well, why? So now it's like, you don't want to be in a movie going, well, why was that person there? Because now you're not in the movie.
This is 87. Is Kevin Bacon not a thing yet? Like,
Kevin Bacon's a thing. In fact, I think there's a reason he was in. I thought they were shooting She's Having a Baby or something.
What is Kevin Bacon's filmography at this point? I'm curious. Because to have him do this part, and he looks like a million bucks, and it's Kevin Bacon, and so you want more. It's an odd choice to use him like this.
So apparently, I'm reading it right now, it was his idea, Bacon's idea. He was filming this movie, and She's Having a Baby. So he enjoyed working with Hughes. He told the director he'd be available for a part, even as an extra. And he was living in Manhattan at the time, so he took the young man, the young actor up on his offer, blah, blah, blah. Yeah, so...
So it was stunt casting.
Yeah.
Interesting. Huh. Well, I don't think take him out because I look forward to that part of the movie. Like, here comes the Kevin Bacon part, right?
Right.
I don't think I'd take him out, but I would want more. I would want him to come back and do maybe a similar bit on the train or something. I don't know. It's something where it's
it like does this, feel like there should be a book ended. Cause like him taking that cab sort of sets the whole thing in motion. Right.
I think so. Yeah.
So he plays a very critical part in the story to a degree. And then we just don't see him again. Uh-huh. So I think like, if you were going to say what Bacon character would you like to see in this movie, it's that one. It's the character he is.
just
more of it.
Just please give it to me the way it should be given to me.
Planes, Trains, and Automobiles with a side of bacon is what you want.
Is this movie better, worse, or on par with a Ron Howard movie?
I'm thinking it's properly Howard.
Yeah, that's
okay. But I now with this monologue thing, I'm thinking, I bet you Ron Howard leaves that in.
Oh, interesting. How could Ron Howard resist that moment of sincerity at the end.
That's why I think so. I was properly Howard all night until that moment. I'm giving this a Howard minus one.
All right, I'm going to say it's still properly Howard, but well taken. Sure, for sure, Howard would make the movie a little bit more sincere at the end. I don't know if you get some of the John Hughes moments. Like, for instance, the way that this movie opens is with a really funny scene with a guy about to say something and never says anything.
Yeah, that's pretty good.
It was just done brilliantly. And that scene could go wrong in a lot of ways. So I don't know, maybe the actor gets credit, but the comedic timing of that scene was just perfect.
Yeah, I agree. It's a great start because it sets up an interesting level of tension and mundanity that is going to be broken up and yeah.
And how do you write that in the script? I mean, it's just such a. I'd be curious to see how that was written in the script.
Yeah,
because it's the first gag. You got to be pretty sure it's going to work. I don't feel like I've seen that in a million movies.
Right.
It did immediately feel John Hughes in a way that isn't John Hughes tropey.
Right.
So anyway, I like that scene a lot. I'm going to say properly Howard. Steve, is there a half the battle or one to grow on moment in this?
Order your shower curtain rings online. Nose blow.
I did it, and then I thought I was done, and I wasn't done.
It's almost like your nose, you had a number two nose blowing experience.
Just so many boogers, so many boogers, so little time. I had a comedy question for you. I doubt this will make the podcast. I've never heard a good booger joke. In my life, I've never heard.
Have you ever heard a booger joke?
I guess there was a bit on Seinfeld where he was like scratching his nose, but it looked like he was picking his nose.
Yeah.
It was okay. I kind of feel like with the booger, there's a reason why you can't ever do a good booger joke, and that is that it just seems so juvenile. It seems like this is the kind of thing that you would laugh at when you were in second grade. But for whatever reason, it's still something that it's universal. It's something that everyone deals with. It's still something that's gross. You'd think that it would be a topic of humor.
I almost started giggling just at the idea of saying boogers. Like boogers is funnier than booger. Like plural boogers.
Like when you say, it's true. Now,
like if you were to say like, I'm going to make you eat boogers. That's really funny.
Okay. Very similar. This is a very similar premise. But the nose hair that sticks out in an embarrassing way.
Mm-hmm.
Like, I feel like, no, you could easily write a joke for that.
Right.
But that doesn't have the juvenile connotation that boogers have.
See, there's boogers. I already laughed because you said a booger joke, and like immediately I'm like, I don't think it could be done. And then you said boogers, and I'm like, nah, that's funny.
It's
the more boogers, the better.
So you're saying that I'm wrong. You're saying that the more boogers that you can work into jokes is will just improve any joke.
I just think that if I said boogers, it's funny, but it's got to be done right. I do a joke where I say snot.
Snot, fine. Boogers feels juvenile. But
I mean, so you're saying specifically a booger joke. So you're saying it's because, I mean, snot is the same thing, right? I mean, snot is, I guess, the liquid form. Booger is the solid.
I feel like, no, I mean, I don't know how the whole thing works, but I would imagine that there's some relationship between snot and boogers.
Yeah, see, snot, I feel more mucusy. Boogers are like its final form.
I do feel like there's a sense in which the word boogers just feels juvenile. And I don't know if there's another word for it. Like
if you saw somebody with a booger on their nose and you were going to tell them, you'd probably do more like, hey, you need to do one of these little things, like squeeze your nose a little bit.
You wouldn't say you have a visible booger, sir. You don't want to be an adult.
Your booger's hanging out. I'm bringing it back, baby.
I think it'd be funny as like a curse. Like, ah, boogers.
Some people get really grossed out by boogers, like more so than poop.
Like, some people, I think that that's it.
Like if I show, like I know
about the grossness of it, and then like the derision, like, ah, this person's so juvenile. He just. Yeah.
We have a mutual friend that when I show one of our mutual friends one of my boogers, he gets viscerally angry. Which, I mean, I probably shouldn't be showing my boogers, but
is it Nathan?
No, it's Jason. And as soon as he reacted, I was like, "Oh, you're gonna be my booger boy from now on."
Well, now that I know that, I'm gonna put that in my back pocket for sure.
And in his defense, it's not like I've compared the two reactions. I've never then like showed him my poop and saw if he like got more upset or not. It's on the to-do list.
Oh, goodness gracious. So, yeah, I guess my assumption was that it would be impossible to come up with a good booger joke because it does have the connotative value of being juvenile, but you're saying this is just an untapped reservoir.
Yeah, I'm thinking it's more, I mean, I don't think I could do like 5 minutes on boogers, but I think incorporating the word boogers has potential to be pretty funny.
Interesting. Okay.
And maybe because it isn't used very much by adults, I wouldn't think.
Is there another word for boogers?
I think snot's your best bet, but I mean, I don't think it tells the story.
It does not. No, absolutely. I mean, a nasal matter? I mean, I don't.
Yeah.
Like, what would the medical journals say?
I think you're asking all the right. Let me see if I can follow. Like, what is the technical term for booger?
Or if there's a synonym
for booger. The technical term for booger is dried nasal mucus, or more simply, nasal mucus.
Again, look, dried nasal mucus, you're telling me that the technical word for booger needs three words.
Yeah.
No doubt about it. There was nasal mucus before humans.
We come from nasal mucus.
That was Darwin's prologue.
Yeah, it's everybody's like, we are all but boogers.
And also my favorite Kansas song as well.
Boogers in the Wind.
Yeah, of course. I think we found it. We found it.
Well, we are laughing.
Found a good booger joke.
Listeners.
Oh, I don't know if any of this is making it in.
Come on!